like to thank Larry Mordoff for giving us the use of his space here. And right now, I want to introduce Tom Gage. He's president of AC Propulsion. They are the company that is spearheading battery development and electric car development. And they're considered the gold standard worldwide for building electric cars that perform well and provide us with the tools to go after the state to demand that the car companies start providing these as well. So right now, Tom Gage will come and talk about his T0 and the lithium-ion batteries and answer any questions that you have afterwards.
Before I start, I got two booklets here. One, and I want these back, by the way. One is about the T0 and our electric car work, and one is about work that probably most of you don't know that we do, and that's remote piloted electric airplanes. And I'm going to pass these around. I'll be talking about some of the stuff in these books as we go. But if you don't have any audio visual aid, this will have to suffice. I guess it was a week or two ago, we've been kind of submerged under all this PR and responses to the news that's out about T0 and the lithium-ion batteries. And a lot of email comes in, and there was an email with us or was posted on one of the lists, I can't remember, somebody writing in, taking me a task for some comments I had made back at CARB hearing many years ago, where I said that as far as AC propulsion was concerned, lead-acid batteries were the only way to go. They were the only batteries that were affordable, and that all this work with nickel metal hydride and lithium ion was a waste of time because they were way, way too expensive. And so, you know, that was interesting because I do remember saying that. It's a very strong part of our operating philosophy. And first of all, I was gratified that somebody's actually paying attention to what I said that long ago. But then I also wanted to think, well, what has changed? And I came to the conclusion that really nothing has changed. Our emphasis on lead-acid batteries back then was based on the fact that we could call up a company and a pallet load of batteries would arrive on our loading dock as long as we sent them a check and return. And that's what we're looking for in a battery for EV. We don't want an experimental battery or a battery that's built by hand in some factory in Japan and costing $100,000 or $200,000 a car. And back when I made that statement, we had just been working with Volkswagen on some nickel metal hydride battery cars. And we actually bought the batteries through our shop, and the bill that we paid was $90,000 per car. So Toyota now says you can replace the RAV4 pack for $30,000. I don't know if the price has come down or if they're subsidized. But back then, nickel metal hydride were, in fact, almost $100,000 a car or more. And some of the stories you heard about the lithium ion batteries that Nissan was playing around with, their Ultra, those prices were eye-watering. I've heard numbers of $500,000 up for one car's worth of batteries. So what I stood back then still stands. We needed a battery we could build cars with, not a battery we could play around with and spend a lot of money on. And that's what we have now with the lithium-ion battery, T0. And that represents what's really changed in those intervening years, is that lithium-ion batteries have become a commercial product. They're real. They aren't intended yet for applications in cars, but they're built by the millions per month, and they're putting computer batteries and a lot of other portable equipment. There are a lot of companies all over the world making them, big factories, and they really understand this product, a very real product. And so by putting it into T0, we haven't changed our philosophy. The philosophy has always been, show me a battery that's real and does what I want it to do, and we'll put it in the car. So that's where we are with batteries, but it also goes back to our original philosophy that we've been working under all along, is that make EVs real, you have to take the best technology that you can build affordably, put it in the car that's optimized for the capabilities and limitations of that technology. Now, several years ago, working with lead-acid batteries, range was very important, so the car had to be as efficient as you could possibly make it, so you could get as much range as you could get. But even then, a good lead acid car is good for maybe 80 or maybe even 100 miles if your batteries are good and the car is very efficient. And so you also want it to be able to charge it wherever you might stop, wherever you could find electricity. And fortunately, electricity is everywhere. Every house up and down the street is a potential charging location if you could plug into that electricity and use it to charge the batteries. So that was the other aspect of our design from the day one, is that you want the car to be able to plug in anywhere. I think the discussion we just had here shows how important it is to have access to charging. When you have complicated devices that cost a lot of money and require a lot of installation, you're going to limit your access to charging per se, and we're seeing the results of that now as these systems are breaking down or they're incompatible or whatever reason. And so it becomes a huge hassle to get electricity, even though electricity is everywhere. So that's another basic feature of AC propulsion design, is that you can literally plug in anywhere and you can use anything from a lamp socket current, which of course takes a pretty long time, all the way up to industrial 80 amp single phase current from a 240 outlet. And that's enough to charge most cars in 1 or 2 hours. So from the very beginning, we've looked at an EV as what do you really want to make it usable to the people based on the technology that's available today, not based on something that committees of auto executives or other people, government officials, have said, this is what we need to get to make it viable. The concept is it's already viable. It's not going to be exactly the same as a gasoline car, but we're going to take what we have today and make it as good as we can. And that's what we've been doing all along. We've always kind of been ambivalent about whether we really want to build cars or not. Our original plan was to just build drive systems. We developed technology. We have the patents on it, which is very unique. And we have the charging system I discussed that's built into the car. So the charger is the same apparatus that drives the car. And this means that you don't carry around an extra charger. So we thought that technology would be of interest to automakers or people who supply automakers. And for the 90s and maybe even into the early 2000s, we were thinking that, you know, a car company or a tier one supplier would show interest in this. But then the whole car thing kind of turned downhill, and it looked like the car companies were going to be out of their obligation under the mandate to produce electric vehicles. So they really had no interest in proceeding beyond the technology that they had already developed. So that made us rethink our approach to how do we commercialize our technology. On the one hand, it was bad. We were making money working with car companies, particularly Volkswagen. And the prospect of thousands and tens of thousands of EVs in production by the car companies made us think, you know, there's got to be some room in there somewhere for us to do something. If they're building all these EVs, in our opinion, such great technology. But that's all gone away. The car companies have effectively completely abandoned the EV market. And it may be possible, of course, to keep some of these cars on the road, but they've all dismantled their factories. They aren't going to be building any more EVs. And even if they wanted to, it would take them 5 years or so to redesign and retool for a new EV. So the cars out there are all you're going to get, and the best wishes is to keep them out there as long as possible. But we're really looking to move on. And in that way, the demise of the mandate and the abandonment of the EV market by the car companies is really good for us. Because as long as they were selling RAV4s, which were a pretty good EV, and the EV1, which was pretty slick, and all these other cars, they were selling them well below their cost, and well below any kind of cost we could match with the production EV that we built. We were locked out of the market. There was no way to compete because the small company, we had to make profit. They're gone now, so we have the market to ourselves, and so we're looking very closely at how we can go in there. We know, and you know, that there is a demand for EVs. We don't know exactly how big it is, what the price-volume relationship would be. Cars that you build by hand, whether they're electric or gasoline or any other kind of car, if you build them by hand, they're going to be more expensive than most people can afford. But EVs do have enough appeal, unique driving characteristics, and general societal benefits that a lot of people who can't afford them, we think, will buy them. And we're not talking big number by automaker standards. We're talking hundreds of thousands of cars. It's a really big business for us. 100 EVs at 40, 1,000 EVs at $40,000 a piece is a $40 million business. Right now we're about a $2 million business. So we see a lot of growth out there, a lot of growth potential. So we're looking at getting into cars, and we built the first T0 back in 1997. We showed it at the LA Auto Show in January of 97. And since that car, we built two more, and those are in customer hands up in Southern California. And it's been a lot of fun, and we've learned, you know, what it would really take to do it. But it's a daunting prospect, because every aspect of that car has to meet the federal motor vehicle safety standards. That alone is a huge engineering task. And they have to be able to build it at a price that people can afford to pay. And well, we started talking about an $80,000 price. Now with the lithium-ion batteries, we're up there $220,000. That's just a made-up number. It's just to get somebody, because that's the first thing everybody asks, is how much would it cost. And the cost, of course, depends hugely on what volume of building, how much that price is. We still want to build it. You know, just driving it around every time I drive it, we've only got to build this car because everybody likes it, everybody wants it. But we want to take a baby step first, and so what we're looking at more closely now is building conversions of conventional cars, taking out all the gasoline, engine and stuff, gas tanks, exhaust pipes, radiators, and putting in our drive system and a battery of some sort. And up until now, we've built many conversions, as I said. We've built them with lead acid batteries, and we've built them with nickel metal hydride batteries. But the problem in building a conversion for sale is that you still have to meet safety certification. And when you put a lead acid pack or a nickel metal hydride pack in a car, you end up with a car that's probably 900 pounds heavier than it was when it came into your shop. And with that much added weight, come up close to the GVW, the gross vehicle weight rating of the car, and you have handling effects and suspension effects and brake effects, none of which are insurmountable. We've been driving really impressive for hundreds of thousands of miles. But in terms of safety certification, it creates a pretty big engineering challenge because you have to go through and recertify for all those aspects of the car. But now we've got lithium-ion batteries, and you can build a lithium-ion car with a 100-mile range that will only increase the vehicle weight by about 200 pounds. And a car with 180-mile range will only increase the weight by about 450 pounds. So this puts it well within the feasibility of certifying these cars without a huge engineering effort, and that's what we're looking at very seriously now. And the car was chosen from a huge list. There's probably 50 or 80 candidates out there that we looked at, and everybody has a favorite. You know, I want you to do this car, this car would be so cool, or, you know, what you need is a luxury car, or an SUV, etc. We went through a huge list, but finally, just out of the need to make a decision and what we discerned were some really excellent characteristics. We're looking most closely right now at the Scion XD, which David Franklin brought an example of out here. And the reason we like it so much is that it's very light for a car of its size. It has a huge interior capacity. I'm 6'1", and we've got a 6'4 guy at the shop. And we all got in the car, sat in all the different seats, drove around, and it's just a great car for tooling around town. It's so easy to get in and out of, and so comfortable once you're in it, that for an EV, that's what you want. It's a car you're going to run a lot of errands in, drive around town. And the fact that it's light, even though it doesn't look too aerodynamic, it is very light. And it's actually got less funnel area than the RAV4 uses. So it may not look that aerodynamic, but it's not going to be that bad either. And down the road, it's built on the same platform as Toyota Echo, which is a much smaller and even lighter car still. The other Scion, the XA, which is a totally different appearance, but it's basically the same. So we can build EVs. Once we've built the conversion for the XD, we can build EV versions of the Echo and the XA without too much additional work. So we'll have a family of EVs just based on this one platform, and we think down the road that's the way to expand the market, is try to provide cars for everyone's life.
They're talking about the 300-mile range technology.
Well, yeah, let me get into the batteries. That's kind of the next thing on my list. Range is the holy grail of people both within and without the EV group, and we kind of reached that holy grail with the T0. And how do we do it? Lithium-ion batteries is the key. But back up a bit, how did we get onto lithium-ion batteries in the first place? And that goes back to this airplane business. It's primarily Alan Koenig here, who worked on all pretty much all his life, both gasoline and electric power. But the electric model airplane or remote control airplane group or cadre, whatever you want to call it, is always on the cutting edge of technology, always looking for more power or more range or more energy, and they go extreme lengths to find it. And so they're always getting the latest batteries that they can buy, buying battery packs and this piece of equipment or that, and disassembling and taking up the batteries and putting them in their airplanes. And Alan was more than peripherally involved in that. He keeps in touch with all that going on. And we started to see that these lithium-ion batteries, which we had dismissed earlier on based on the performance of car-sized batteries, were starting to put out some very decent, in fact, even incredible levels of power. And you might think energy is the key thing with battery, but the power is just as important. You need to get a certain amount of power on a given size of battery, or you can't run your car, you can't run your airplane. And that had been the problem all along with lithium-ion batteries. You get tons of energy out of them, but to get enough power, you need a really huge pack, and that wasn't suitable for either cars or airplanes. But these new batteries, you can discharge them, and fully discharge them in a quarter of an hour at the 4C rate. Some of the other batteries even higher than that. So that's got to be a very useful level of power, energy demand from the battery. And having seen that, put them in one of these airplanes, and they work. And not only did they work fantastically well. They work like a magic battery because as much electricity as you put in, measured in amp hours, you get almost exactly the same amount back out. And there's no funny business at end of charge like you have with nickel metal hydride batteries. There's no big sag under high power discharges like you have with almost every other kind of battery. They really do exactly what it wants them to do, which is to take in electricity efficiently and give it out just as efficiently as you need it and as fast as you need it. And they hold a lot of electricity, so you can do that for a long time. So, you know, we found that out. That was probably sometime in the middle of last year, or maybe even earlier, and we started kicking it around in the shop and didn't know what to do. Didn't have a lot of money to do it with. And then last December, at the EV show in Florida, I was telling the guy from Epson, Bob Graham, the Electric Power Research Institute, that you know, we were playing around with lithium-ion batteries, and they looked pretty good. And all of a sudden, they looked great. I didn't mention the price, but again, these batteries are in mass production, and so compared to the $500,000 per car price that we associated with lithium-ion, these batteries were available, although not to the general public, but were available for much less than 10 of that. So it started to be a very real-looking product. And I mentioned this to Bob Graham of EPRI, and this is the way things work. He said, well, you know, I got about $25,000 in my budget that I have to get rid of. This was December 15th. I have to get rid of it before the end of the year. So why don't you write me up a proposal and you can build us some of these batteries and test them. And I said, well, that sounds like a good plan. We did that. And by January, we were kicked off. We not only had to build these batteries, but we had to build a battery management system so they could test them. And we kicked it back and forth a little bit, but we shut off running. And that's what we did. We delivered these batteries in May. But that project, was enough to get us started. It allowed us to develop the battery management system that we're using in T0 today, and it allowed us to start learning how to assemble these batteries into an automotive-sized pack. And just so you know what I'm talking about, these are the cells. This is called an 18650 lithium-ion cell. 18650 is 18 millimeters in diameter and 5 millimeters long. It's kind of a standard. It's kind of like a AA or a D cell or something. It's the standard that's used in each portable equipment. You put 6 or 8 or more of these cells in a pack with a little battery management system on it. Put it in a pack that pays to sell the battery for $100 to $200. But this is what's in there, these cells. And so we assemble these cells to EPRI and learn how to do that. And then another thing that happened kind of out of the blue is that my neighbor, who's got a food, had an EV1 they took away, and then he went out and bought a Ford Ranger.
and then he got one of the last draft cores, so now he has two DVDs of his dry wood. But he's always hanging around. And he brought a guy at work who worked with him over at my house one day, and we talked, and this guy was really enthusiastic. That had a PVO there at my house in Southern California. But he took a ride in it, and the next thing now he's talking about investing in the company and wanting to buy a P0. So he said, well, what we really want to do is put lithium-ion batteries in the P0. We know how to do it with the battery management system, but it's still a big step. They just small packs, just 12 cells each or so, to building a full-size car. He said, okay, here's my investment. Can you use the stock in the company? And if that car works, the lithium-ion P0, if that works, then I want you to build me a car, too. His name is Martin Eberhardt, and he did buy the stock, did build a P0 here today. So, you know, these two sort of ad hoc events, you know, the meeting at the Petri, and then this guy came by my house, and, you know, within a few years of time, was really made a major move forward in developing lithium-ion batteries for EVs.
Could you pass that thing around, maybe?
Yeah. It's got tape on it, so it should be pretty safe.
How long did it take you to charge that car?
That car, the battery is about 50 kilowatt hours, and we can charge at maximum 20 kilowatts, so that would be a 2.5 hour charge. Typically, we charge more like 10 to 12 kilowatts, of course. I'll get more into the P0 in just a minute.
A question on the battery. Most EV drivers don't drive 300 miles, obviously you can't drive 300 miles on a charge. We're used to plugging in every night at home. How does the lithium battery perform under shallow cycles where you're only discharging, you know, 50 or 100 miles out of it and then charging it every night? Do you have any idea what kind of life to expect out of this battery? Because one thing that we've been very pleased with on the nickel metal seen by Edison and Toyota is the longevity of the nickel metal battery compared to some of the lead acid batteries.
We have mostly anecdotal evidence. The question is, what is the life of these batteries? And data point one is the manufacturer rates them at 400 full depth of discharge cycles. And item number two is that some of the people use lithium batteries, but not specifically this type of battery, so the depth of charge is more important than depth of discharge in second life. And if you charge it only to 90% as opposed to fully 100%, this guy's voice will likely become infinite. Now, probably it isn't infinite, but it's hugely non-limited. But if you typically don't charge them all the way, but only to 90%, that the light increases dramatically. And of course, that also goes through, I believe, what people have told me, that's true also for depth of discharge. Typically, you don't discharge the battery all the way, but that's how they test them, just so they stand the test. So while it's rated at 400 cycles, we are expecting much more than that because of the automotive use, especially in the car like a P0, which really is over-battery, if you will. It's got more battery than you typically need. And so it's typical. Depth of discharge per day is only about 10% or so.
And who builds the battery?
The cell I passed around is built by LG Chem, a Korean giant company. But many companies throughout the world build these batteries.
Louder, please. Louder.
The EV1 was an excellent car.
His.
Unfortunately, it was taken away from the consumer.
For you, it is.
The RAV4 EV was, again, is a good car. Not a great car in comparison to EV1, but consumers didn't have a choice in that. Okay, now that was taken away. Your choice in the XB, I kind of find a little bit confusing, because it does not have a low coefficient of drag and has no power. The vehicle does not have a lot of power. So why convert this vehicle versus a vehicle that has a low coefficient, of drag, like the new Prius is coming out, for example, which doesn't have a low coefficient of drag? Why not let the vehicle look like that?
You got about 3 hours? No, it's a hugely complex thing, and the car you mentioned, the Prius, is really an excellent choice. But our criteria were how good of an EV will it make based on not just EV aspects of efficiency, but you know, general usability for a wide range of different people. A lot of people like the EV1, but they couldn't carry a kid in it, so long as they see for this. There's all kinds of trade-offs. So long as how good of a car, what would be the range of appeal? The second thing was,
how easy would it be to convert? That could be very difficult to be possible to look at the way it played out.
And the third thing, frankly, is price. You know, when you look at what cars cost and people pay for cars and what they get, we're up at the $40,000, $50,000, $70,000 now. We're looking at people who can say, well, you know, I can buy an EV for $70,000, but I don't have that credit, I'd rather have a BMW. So price is extremely critical in any car we might build if we want to maximize our the number of people we might consider to cost. So if you look at the Scion, it's sticker 14.2, Prius is 20, the Mini is about 18. And you know, that difference doesn't sound like a lot. You know, that difference could end up being sort of profit and loss for us. They're very, very tight.
Is
there
the bulk of the consumer that actually bought the EV and still do? Are the commuters. Not the family, but more the commuters. So, that, I mean, the biggest concern we have now is the
I guarantee that our TV version will out-accelerate the gas. One thing, we're not adding that much weight, and that's again because of lithium-ion batteries. The other thing is, we're pretty well known for the high power level of our drive system. It's much more powerful than the RAV4 system. Probably 50% more powerful than the EV1 drive system.
Yeah.
And the Scion with batteries will weigh less than the EV1. The base model will weigh less than the EV1. And the high performance version will weigh about the same. So for the, it's hard to project. I haven't done a very exhaustive simulation, but the high performance version will have 100 feet more range. It should be well below 7 seconds if you have 6 a lot faster.
What about the 100 mile range
version? All I'm saying is it's under 10 seconds. It'll be faster than a RAV4.
And the 20 mile range version would be. That's great.
Doesn't the Scion make a better fleet sale vehicle?
Well, that's the other big factor. Is we may have been led down a garden lane here, but Southern Cal Edison said initially talked to him and said, well, what we really want is pickups. And I said, well, you can drive a RAV4 EV, it did work okay for you, so cutting out pickup. And we asked them about a variety of cars, including the XB, and they came back to me and said, you know, we talked to our fleet guys and those people, and the XB would be okay, we could put that in the fleet. Now they're waffling a bit because they're used to dealing with the car companies with all their legions of sales and warranties and support and everything. They see dealing with us as a risk, which admittedly would be, but they don't have any choice, so they're not sure whether the conservatism is going to keep them, so they end up driving a natural gas car, which is less.
Yeah, well, Toyota then honor the drivetrain warranty, and you would have to deal with the powertrain warranty?
From what I understand, there's a law that car companies have to honor the warranty on modified cars. If the car that broke is not modified. And we're hopeful that we can have good relations with Toyota in this process, but we haven't really approached anything corporate level at all. Couldn't have gotten a lot of help from the dealership. There's a lot of food you have to do for that.
A question on the lithium-ion chemistry.
Talk about that. What we did here is we took
How do you get them all to stay connected?
Actually, Don, what will it sell for when it's converted to?
We don't know for sure. We're aiming for a base price of 100-mile version on Pilot or RAV4 EV.
Okay.
Whether that's realistic or not.
Is it feasible to get Toyota to sell you the vehicle with no powertrain?
Those cars are built in Japan. And to move a car without an engine from the factory to the truck to the ship, the trucks and dealer, it costs more than you save.
Really?
Guys that push cars can get one. But Frank, you know, that's a good question. We think we have it potentially. It's a bit of a long shot. But those engines, any automotive engine, but particularly small four-cylinder engines, for it,
have value
as power plants or hybrid auxiliary power units. Gasoline engine was designed and incredibly clean. I'm sure they're talking all new engines, not diesel engines, but good engines. If we put one of our hybrid alternators on the back of that engine, we can sell it to hybrid bus companies. They'll have a better power unit than they have a capstone or a diesel generator. So that's sort of a second order part of our business plan that hasn't been fleshed out.
That's great.
I
haven't heard you say anything about green cars or hybrids.
Yeah, we've had rechargeable hybrids since the mid-90s. It's always been in the form of a gasoline generator and a small trailer. Yeah,
I think
that's
a good idea.
Yeah, so we'll talk about it. We recently completed a car that they're having on sale. It did well. It was, it wasn't quite as clean as the gasoline cars. But what the results don't really show is that normally it's starting to be going around on electricity all day long.
Would it be more affordable to buy because the battery package is long?
No, probably it's about the same as the There's no reason it would be different.
It's more affordable than a full electric one.
We did that as an R&D project, and the one reason we haven't pursued it to a great degree is that the second car is not around. There's no way we can blow a car with a cabin and deal with all the emissions issues. We don't want to get that on. Why Detroit's having trouble with hybrids, I don't know. Maybe they have a price of massive money for it. Meanwhile, the Japanese are going to change. So I don't know if it's a money issue or a technology issue. Is that lithium-ion cell out there somewhere? You know, working with these batteries puts range in a little bit of a different light, because one of the neat things about these batteries is that with normal batteries, they come in maybe one or two different sizes and say, if I put this battery in my car, I get so much range, this is much the pain that packs it on the car. Or if I go with a bigger size module, I get more range, there's even more work to put in the car. There's no in between. The way we use these batteries is we take some number of them, at least 30, put them in a block, and we connect them all together in parallel. So they're all held at the same voltage with the current collector plate on each side of the block. And that becomes a building block. And you can build that building block in a variety of different sizes and shapes just by varying how many cells are used and how many we put in the rectangular array. So that leads to say, you know, what's the space limit in the car? How much range do you want? How much power do you want? You play with all these games, and you know, the basic unit is this thing. There's calculations, which you never think of doing with normal batteries. But if you have an electric car that gets 200 watt hours per mile on the road, this cell will take you 195 feet. Now, we run our cars at 370 volts, so you have to have 100 of these. So 100 of these can take you about 4 miles. So that's the building block. And if you look at the current price of these that we pay, and then the work to assemble them and, you know, add retail markup and the like, so that if you're a dealership and say, I want a battery that has this much range, kind of a retail type price for range. It comes out to about $125 a mile. So that's a number to keep in mind. It could vary a little bit either way. But when we talk about 300-mile range, how many people are going to pay that extra $20,000 to go from 100-mile range to 300-mile range? Some people will. But think how often you use that. If you drive that way every day, it's a good deal. If you only take a trip every other weekend or once a month and use that range, you just got it sitting there in your driveway and you haven't used it. So we think, you know, the holy grail, as Dan mentioned, 300 miles, it's certainly desirable. More range is always better. When you put it in stark dollar and cents terms, we think, and that's why we're going to have two versions of the Triumph, we think that a lot of people, especially experienced EV users who know that, you know, what their daily driving patterns really are, will opt for the lower range. It could be wrong, but the advantage of these is you can go either way. It's not a big deal. That's the other factor that's really a bit unknown is how much durability you buy by going with somewhat over 10,000.
What do you think the future price structure of lithium ion batteries looks like? I have a feeling they're coming down pretty quickly.
They are. I got some data. It was a little bit shaky, but the price per kilowatt hour has come down by about 7 times since 1998. Pretty linear decline, and I don't think it's going to continue at that rate forever. But we got some. We were meeting with a Chinese battery company, and the Chinese engineer was there, and the U.S. sales rep was there. And the sales rep couldn't shut up the engineer, and he was talking about how their cost of production for the batteries in the T0 is about $12,000. You can do the arithmetic, and that's less than half of we pay for this. So whether that's the factory cost or what cost he was talking about, we don't really know. But there's a lot of room there, and we're a small buyer. We paid pretty much, quote-unquote, full retail for these batteries because we only bought 8,000 of them. And the guys that make computer batteries buy the tens or hundreds of thousands at a time. So there's a lot of room to come down in the price we paid already.
How about the cell size? How about going up in size?
Cell size?
Yeah, in time, instead of having all these billions.
If they start making larger cells in the same volume that have the same performance as these, which we'd love to look at it. But, you know, again, it comes down to what can you buy that really works and what's the best deal. And most of the larger cells we've seen don't have as much energy per weight, they don't have as much energy per size, they don't have as much power, they're just not as good.
Obviously, batteries do have problems right off the shelf. How does that, do you have that or sell it to you, and why? Do you even know about it?
Yeah, I'm looking with a guy up in Palo Alto who works for Loral, they build space satellites. And he says what they do is there are companies that are actually taking the same thing, commercial off the shelf technologies, and what they call upstream. They take a big batch of these cells to the test. They reject the bad ones right off the bat. That's for space for military applications. For automotive, it's probably not worth it because you build a block that might have 30 or 50 cells in it, and then if some of the cells are bad, I mean, you have to assume it's going to have a very high accept rate, like 99.9%. So if you build a few blocks and they turn out bad, whether you can reprocess them or just scrap them, it becomes an economic decision. From what we've seen so far, general uniformity of these batteries that they come off the line looks like a
The question
is whether altitude or temperature affect the batteries. Certainly for space applications you have to worry about altitude. It's not an issue at all for cars. Temperature is very critical. We control the temperature. High temperature is worth going up to 15 below that. We don't have experience with low temperature, but the manufacturer says we don't work pretty well below 0. So colder weather makes it a problem. That's why I live in California.
Lithium used to have a reputation for being less stable when you charge it, and obvious overcharging the batteries and creating fire and so forth. How complicated is it to get stable charging infrastructure for lithium batteries?
All that has to be on the car. It has to be built into the car. The question is, how can you control charging so that it's stable and doesn't cause problems? And most of the problems you see are where they haven't been monitoring every cell, so they don't really know what the cell voltage is. If they're charging a string, they don't know what the voltage is at each cell within that string. You have to know what the voltage is on each cell, and you have to avoid point over voltage. To do that, from what we've seen and what we've talked to battery companies about, you don't have any problems. So, it doesn't seem to be much smart outboard the car, onboard the car. I think I've covered most of the stuff. Be glad to answer questions.
Could you speak directly to the performance specs of the T0? I know most of us know it already, but there are a few people who don't.
Yeah, the T0 was built from the start to be an extreme car with lead-acid batteries. It did 0 to 60 in 4.1. That was tested by Rodentrack at the Mona racetrack. And it had a good 80-mile range. You could get well over 100 if you really drove it like an economy car. And that car weighed about 2,500 pounds. That was with lead-acid batteries. So when we started looking at the specs of these, we realized that we could get the same power from a pack of these. They had about three or four times the energy, so we'd get that faster on the range. And we'd save 500 pounds on the weight with the same power. We started to get extremely interested in doing that. I told you the story of how that happened. So the results were very predictable. We did predict them pretty closely to what we got, is that the range would be around 300 miles. And on Thursday, I drove from where I live up in the Bay Area to Santa Barbara on a single charge, 60 miles an hour on 101. And I pulled into the bus depot in Santa Barbara where they do their electric bus maintenance. Driving fine. The battery was not complaining. 302 miles and 130 amp hours. Packs rated by the factory at 132 meters. So the range, the energy is very real. You can use it on the highway to get all of it out. Before the trip up north, we did some acceleration tests. The first test was at California Speedway. This is pretty much straight out of the box. The traction control wasn't set up. Alan was driving the car. You hear it launching. It was losing traction. It was shuddering. It was making all kinds of terrible noise. Wasn't getting good traction. He was on and off the accelerator pedal. And the auto-weed timing apparatus gave him a 4.1 second time. So that was the same as the old car with, you know, just terrible performance. So we fixed the traction control. We didn't have access to the track for the auto-weed. But we did some other tests on charge. And track, you know, our shop, so we have some good roads to test it on. And using a G-meter, Alan got a number of different runs, 2.5, 2.6, 2.6. And Chris Dixon from the New York Times took the car out. Again, he was able to do this at this time. So that kind of acceleration is pretty real. And it's very, you know, when you're down at that level, it's very dependent on the traction, the higher the boat interface, and other factors, especially if everything high, just to be able to do something. So, of course, second 060 is no problem with the car. There was a question earlier about how we actually put the batteries in, and just to go over that briefly, we took 68 of these cells in a block. So it's just a rectangular block, kind of like a big thick book. And 25 of those down each side of the car have a fairly elaborate fiberglass enclosure that provides support and also provides airflow so that you blow air through each block individually to get cooling. And it kind of gives all the power wires as well as the fabric monitor wiring harness. And these are 100% fiberglass. There's no metal at all within the self-contained enclosure of the battery connecting wires themselves. So it's intended to be as foolproof self-contained and sealed as possible. And then we blow air through the pack, the dry air and through a filter, and blow it through the pack, down the side of the top. So it follows the practice we use for lead acid that takes advantage of some lessons we've learned, and also made an attempt to be a little more scrupulous in keeping the battery machine all sealed inside the factory. Probably next week we can think I'll probably get an inspector to see how it's held up over the past month, which has been, by anyone's standards, pretty rigorous. You know, trip to San Francisco back
2 hours on the racetrack, probably a dozen test drives with brutal magazine riders and the like. Still running pretty good. So.
From what Greg Hassel was saying, it sounds as though CARB has sort of set the standards for what's needed, or what they think is needed anyway, in terms of a new vehicle, an alternative fuel vehicle with very low emissions. And it sounds as though AC Propulsion has a vehicle that can actually meet those standards, and the fuel cell vehicles are supposedly going to be able to meet those standards. It looks to me like we're at the beginnings of a great race. Are you considering possibly taking up a challenge in that respect and joining a race?
I'm not at all worried about fuel cell cars. Up until the bend, none of them finished more than half the event for one reason or another. Whether they were afraid the performance wouldn't be good enough and they didn't run them, or they had technical problems. But acceleration they didn't run, braking tests they didn't run. Had their own separate efficiency run without on the track at a different time from the other cars. To me, that whole fuel cell thing is just a big hype. And it's not going to happen.
Yeah, I think the race is to get down to the price level that's needed. And it looks as though you're ahead right now.
Well, if you talk to auto engineers, the fuel cell cars are costing $2 million each to build. So...
So we just have to see who chases down the cost curve faster.
It's not a race.
I mean, we're already at the finish line, and they've already started. So, you know, I was talking to a guy from one of the car companies up in Bend, and he said, you know, they're actually worried that the hydrogen lift is taking on too much of a life of its own.
Thanks to Bush. Woohoo!
And they want to start backing away, because, you know, eventually they're going to be held to account. You know, GM's out there, PR people anywhere out there saying, we're going to be able to build a million fuel cell cars in a decade. And the engineers aren't there. They say it's not going to happen. It's 30 or 40 years off, if ever. So I don't see that as... I see the race as being when CARB and other government agencies get on board, and CARB is in a peculiar position because their reason for being is clean air. But clean air isn't the only reason for electric cars. So when you talk to them about energy and petroleum imports and things like that, that really are as important or even more important now than clean air, because conventional cars are so clean now. They say we don't have any authority on that. That's not our job. But if you look at this country, we use 45% of the world's gasoline and we have 5% of the population. My personal view is that we either conserve gasoline, use less gas, or fight more wars. I think that's pretty stark truth, but I think it's real. And electric cars have the advantage they don't use petroleum. They use energy. They may use it efficiently or inefficiently, but they don't use petroleum. They use energy, sun, wind, hydro, nuclear, gas, coal, but they don't use petroleum. Almost no generators are fueled by petroleum.
I think that's a really big, important point on electricity compared to hydrogen or petroleum-based fuels, that you have the flexibility to get the energy from anywhere, and it's delivered very efficiently over an existing infrastructure, and then very efficiently utilized by the pure EVs.
That's true, and that's one of the things that really gets my goat with particularly GM. They're the worst, because they march these PR people out who really don't know what they're talking about. And they'll say, well, you can make hydrogen from natural gas or from other fuels, and sure, it has a little emissions thing. But the real solution is to use renewable energy to make your hydrogen. And then your car is completely 100% pollution free. What they don't tell you is that to make hydrogen that way using renewable electricity uses incredible amounts of energy. It uses electricity. And so if they use electricity generate hydrogen to run a fuel cell car, they're going to use four times as much electricity as it would take to run a battery car over the same distance. So when they say we can just use all of the renewable energy for our fuel cell cars, they can do that, but if they use battery cars instead, they have four times as many cars.
Another argument you might try on them is if you owned a hydrogen factory and a solar power plant, you wouldn't use your solar power plant to run your hydrogen factory. You'd sell your solar power in the daytime, and you buy cheap electricity at night to make your hydrogen. So they can't assign credit for their clean.
Yeah, electricity is totally fungible is the word, not very many people know what it means, but it means you can interchange it for any use. So if they're using all the clean energy to make hydrogen, that means they're just going to have to use that much more dirty energy for all the other uses of electricity.
What was that word?
Fungible.
Money, electricity, and both fungible.
One other thing I involved in studying once, if you did have that source of hydrogen to use for your engine, if you just as well off to burn it in an internal combustion engine, still... No emissions. It's a very, it's an efficient hybrid, hybrid hydrogen powered internal combustion engine would be just as efficient, or more, actually more efficient than fuel.
Yeah. Back to talk to anybody else.
In terms of the batteries that you create or that system, it seems that that application with smaller electric vehicles, electric bikes, and small electric scooters, so that could have a very powerful impact on what's
going to
happen.
And
are there manufacturers gearing into that now already?
I believe they are. I read about the electric bike cells. And the problem there, if there is one, is that these manufacturers of lower cost, kind of high volume things like bikes utilized, are not used to the rigor with which they have to control their batteries. So they end up trying to take shortcuts, either with the charger or the management system.
It has to be built with a high level of technology.
I'd like to point out something. I think in this discussion, I think we get lost a little bit because we must keep in mind that a fuel cell vehicle is an electric vehicle. So, sort of like you're speaking negative of who you're really. I mean, there's a conflict there because.
All my remarks, except at this point, they don't have electric motors, and neither have any application of combustion on board. So, some of the writings and stuff I've done, there are some different fuel cells and electric batteries. Pretty much everything I've said applies to battery electric vehicles. Fuel cell electric vehicles, and if they had a battery,
they'd be able to get all the fuel cells off and put in the battery.
Are there any other questions for Tom right now? I want to thank Tom for coming down here and bringing the video. We would like to, I know I want to see it, I know a lot of the others here want to see the performance for ourselves. And we've got a great, nice, smooth road out there, very little traffic. And if we could see somebody get in there and punch it a little bit, I think it's a nice, helpful. Safe situation. And
who's got the juice with the Santa Monica PD here?
I don't. Are you going to run them, right?